request Senator Bruce Starr to come forward and tell us about Senate Bill 891.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, member of the committee, Senator Metzger. Good morning.
Morning.
For the record, I'm State Senator Bruce Starr, representing Senate District 15 in Western Washington County, representing the communities of North Plains, Forest Grove, Cornelius, and Hillsborough. I appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 891 this morning. This is a relatively simple bill that addresses an issue that we've heard a lot about in the news recently. As you all know, we've had hundreds of Oregon men and women who have served overseas in a variety of military capacities with the National Guard or the Reserves. And as we've all come to find out, as they've come home, situation is that a number of these men and women are without jobs. And what this bill really does is it supports those men and women by providing an incentive for their employers to one, hold a position for them, but also to encourage employers to maintain an income stream, because many of those men and women have left family members here who, for a variety of reasons, endure their own economic hardships because the breadwinner or a supplemental income has been taken away. This bill is again simple. It allows an employer credit against income taxes for amounts paid as compensation to employees who are members of military reserves, National Guard, or other militia during the period in which the employees are providing active duty military service. It's very simple. There's three amendments to the bill that you have as a percentage of the fill in the blank, as there's a blank on line 13. I'd leave it to the wisdom of this committee to determine what the appropriate level of credit ought to be. We heard this bill in the General Government Committee, and the members of the General Government Committee believed it would be more appropriate for the members of the Revenue Committee to determine the appropriate level of credit. But found that, as we heard, a number of bills related to our military men and women, servicemen and women, and the issues that I think this legislature wants to address some of the overall challenges that those men and women have had, both in their service and as they come back. I think this is one of those ways that we can assist and honor those men and women have sacrificed so much for us. So, Mr. Chair, that's why we've got a bill in front of you. I appreciate the opportunity to testify this morning. Again, I'd leave it to your good wisdom as far as what that level of credit should be, and the legislative revenue staff maybe to do the analysis about what makes the most economic sense. And I know there's costs involved in this, and so we need to weigh those as well. So I appreciate, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, the opportunity to spend a couple of minutes with you this morning.
Thank you. Questions of Senator Starr?
I do.
Yes, Senator Metzger.
Senator Starr, I was wondering, in the General Government Committee, if you had this discussion, or if not. One thing that's interesting, some of the things we've read about, say, our National Guard folks and things, is not only difficulty getting jobs when they come back, but at least we've heard anecdotally, and don't have any outside research to confirm, that about some individuals not getting their jobs back, even though the law says that you need to hold those types of positions open for folks. But we have heard stories, and the Oregonian has recounted some about people mysteriously don't have jobs when they have come back, assuming they did. And I was just wondering if you're having any discussion about, say, something like this, where employer, someone who's worked for them is away, they're paying, they're getting a credit, that there's also some kind of carrot there, is that, by the way, to get this credit, you got to make sure this job, that they don't come back, you've been getting a credit for paying them, which was nice of you to do, and then come back and they don't have a job. And I was just wondering if there was any discussion about, ensuring that, that for at least X amount of period upon returning to state that they're still employed with them in return for getting this credit.
That's a good point, and we did not have that discussion in the committee as it relates to this particular bill. And I think that would be, that's a legitimate issue. It's on the one side to provide this incentive to the employer, and then they take advantage of that. Here comes the soldier back from the front lines, and what's to say that the job could go away? So I think that's a pretty important sideboard that we might want to put into this particular bill.
Yeah, I think they think about an amendment or something like that to make sure that they also recognize their responsibility in lieu of that credit to also make sure that this individual has an opportunity to be employed when they return. Yeah.
Thank you, Senator Brzezinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to follow up on what we just discussed here. I'm kind of mystified. If the employer is currently paying their employee while they're on active duty to get this tax credit, if we put the requirement that they have to have a job when they come back, does that potentially mean that these employers are going to not let's say want that credit and just basically fill the slot because they meet the criteria of the, under the statute there are certain criteria they have to meet to that they can fill the slot. I'm just concerned that we, as much as we want to make certain they have the jobs when they come back, because we all want that we may actually keep them from getting compensation from their employer while they're on active duty. And so I'm not real sure, I apologize for getting in late, as to how the credit works, as to what they have to be paying during the time they're on active duty. That's my only reservation to tag it, that they have to also to get that credit, because it's almost one of those things that we may be putting the employer in such a situation that there's a change in economics or a situation where they have to make a change while this individual is serving, that we somehow undercut our part of our intent.
You mentioned that there were some amendments coming. I think those are on the way, that we don't have those.
Well, there's three, basically, but all they do is fill in the blank on line 13, and one fills it in with the number 100, one fills it in with the number 75, and one fills it in with the number 50. So it would be 100%, 75%, or 50%. And, we have to have some, analysis done and see what the costs would be there. But, if the committee wanted to adopt one of those or another one, then, clearly it would be up to the committee's prerogative to make that choice. And I think that Elizabeth may have the opportunity at a future time to run those numbers and see what those costs might be.
Yeah, and Chairman Starr, I should be able to, at least look at this. It is pretty difficult to get at the data. I mean, I think all of you can probably understand. I mean, we're talking about 1,600 National Guard members serving overseas, but, what portion of them, are really currently getting compensated, in their current job. I don't know that percentage, but maybe I can talk with somebody at the military and see if they can, give us some kind of a survey on that kind of an issue. As far as Senator Prozanski's issue, the credit, as far as how it's calculated, it has to be the amount of compensation that they've been paying, okay, during that period they were overseas. So that is the function of the credit. The credit is only based on the amount that was paid while they were overseas. So.
Anything further?
Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity this morning.
Thank you. We have no one else signed up to testify. We now have a committee quorum, so I reopen the committee with a quorum and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 891. We will now open the public hearing on Senate Bill 403.
Chairman Starr and committee members, with Senate Bill 403, this is dealing with that the rural Medicare, medical provider tax. So basically it's increasing the annual maximum cap on the rural medical provider tax credit. And this tax credit is currently has a cap of $5,000. This increases it to $10,000 beginning tax year 2006 and beyond. And what it also does is index then that maximum annual cap to changes in inflation beginning tax year 2007. So with this, I've given you just a revenue impact statement as well as this. The Office of Rural Health also gave me some information on just the number of practitioners that are taking the tax credit. And to make sure everyone's clear, it's not just for physicians. You've got also there nurse practitioners, physician's assistants, anesthesiologists, dentists, optometrists, podiatrists. And in 2003, there was a total of 1,671 medical practitioners taking the tax credit. So this just kind of breaks it down for you in their data. And then given that kind of data, then I looked at how much doubling the tax credit maximum amount would be in a revenue loss for the state. And this, again, is on their personal income taxes of those medical providers. So beginning in 2006-07, and it would be roughly $6 million, and then per biennium, maybe roughly $12 million. So it's roughly $6 million a year as far as revenue loss from doubling that annual cap.
Thank you. And you on this one? Senator Westland and Senator Bates, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Senator Ben Westland, District 27, here to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 403. We appreciate you giving us the opportunity to be here this morning. I think, as most of you know, the impetus behind Senate Bill 403 is to get and incent rural physicians and healthcare providers to either stay or relocate into underserved areas of the state. I look at some of the recent data that has been presented here from the good offices of legislative revenue and the cost associated with this legislation. I'd like to make a couple of comments with regard to these figures. First of all, what I don't see associated with any of these macro numbers is what I would call the benefit of the medical offset. That is, people that are receiving these medical benefits that are getting primary preventative care in doctor's offices that are not then going to the hospital with much more severe and egregious illnesses or injuries. So I think we need to calculate some of the medical offset in these calculations, in these fiscal impacts. Also, I would wonder if there is the ability for many of these physicians, DOs, physician assistants, to actually utilize the full amount of the tax credit. These are generally rural areas where there is a much higher percent of either uninsured or underinsured Translate revenue coming into their offices is greatly diminished. So I would ask that maybe we look a little more closely at the revenue, and perhaps Elizabeth has done that. But those are my comments with regard to some of the fiscal numbers. And then, if we must, because this is so important, this is a demographic dynamic of our society. I mean, we are all getting older, as are the physicians, with the exception of Senator George.
Others.
We are all getting older, and many of these physicians and healthcare providers in these rural areas are reaching retirement age. We are approaching a crisis in our rural areas to be able to provide health care providers to the citizens of those areas. So we have got to do something to get younger physicians that have recently graduated from medical school to, excuse me, first rule broken. We've got to do something to replace these physicians that are retiring. So if we need to look at the scope of the practices or definition of rural, I think we are very willing to do that. Thank you very much. Be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Westland, a few years ago when I represented the Central Oregon Coast, one of the things that we were recognizing very quickly was that a lot of people love to retire to the coast, but a lot of doctors were leaving the coast because they just absolutely couldn't sustain a practice. And when we got to 5,000 in place, I had a doctor come up to me and said, "Do you realize that that credit that you guys just passed is the only reason I'm able to stay here?" His practice was that close to a financial failure. He said, not even considering what he could make if he moved into the valley and moved into the main urban areas. But, I mean, I think this is absolutely critical. I mean, I'm really curious how many people would even be able to use the 10,000. But do we have any numbers as to how many people are at that pivot point that might, in fact, decide I'm just going to have to move to the valley and move to California or some other place and not have practice? Because many of them were the only practitioner in that community.
I do not have those numbers. Perhaps legislative revenue does. Perhaps we can get them. Maybe Karen Whitaker, who is going to testify on behalf of this bill, has those numbers. But you are exactly correct, Senator. I mean, this is a go, no-go, make-or-break decision for these physicians. And it's not that they're trying to maximize revenue. They could relocate and double, triple their revenue. They're trying to be able to make ends meet and still provide the dedicated compassionate service that they provide. It's absolutely essential.
Thank you. Senator Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Starr and Chair and fellow senators. For the record, Alan Bates. I'm a state senator from Medford Ashland District 3. We are in a budget time when we're all being looked at very carefully about tax credits, and I realize that. But, you know, there are tax credits that really are appropriate, and I think many of us realize that. And I want to talk about this particular one because this is appropriate. I believe this one actually represents savings to the state, not cost to the state, and I'll explain why in a minute. I want to paint for you a quick picture of what it's like for a rural physician in our state, and why we're losing those rural physicians and why those physicians that are coming to the state are primarily locating in large cities. And the reason they're doing that is lifestyle and financial. If you're a rural physician in the state, you're going to be on call almost 27/4 in many areas. Your life as far as having a family life and time off is very, very limited, if at all. Even getting away for a vacation for 4 or 5 days can be difficult for these physicians to bring somebody else in to cover their practice. You combine that with the fact that they make substantially less money for doing that. It wasn't more than 20 years ago when a rural physician was noted for working extremely hard, but actually making pretty good incomes. The pay systems were very different than 20 years ago for primary care, which is what we're talking about here. There's been a huge shift in the healthcare industry of who gets paid what as far as physicians are concerned. And primary care has been just about wiped out financially in the rural areas because of pay differential between that and what's being paid for subspecialty care in the big cities. There's very little incentive for anyone to go in the rural areas in our state right now. And we're going to lose that rural care if this continues. That erosion is going to continue. As an example, one of my friends, Chuck Hoffman, who's a fine physician out of Ontario, up to 5 years ago had 4 partners. He has no partners left. He relies on his 3 physician assistants to run his practice. And if Chuck retires and Chuck's getting a little older, I don't know who's going to fill that slot out there in Ontario. We have a hospitalist program at Rogue Valley Hospital, which I helped set up. And I was kind of shocked to find it's primarily being staffed by rural physicians who have left LeGrand and other areas come in to run this program because of lifestyle and pay. they could make more working a shift, 8-hour, 12-hour shift, 2 or 3 days a week at the hospital than they made working 7 days a week, night and day, in the Grand area. And this process continues. We're going to be in a situation where we'll have very little or limited rural health. So what does that mean to us just on a financial basis for the state? If you look at what we call the payer mix in rural areas, you'll find that you have a high percentage of organ health plan patients, a high percentage of uninsured individuals, and a very low percentage of commercial pay, which is where the real money is. Those commercial pay are in the big cities. So what happens when somebody gets sick in, let's take a small town like Burns, and we've lost all our physicians there, if that were to happen? That person would have to travel to probably Bend. They would get there late in their illness. They might end up in an emergency room where they'd be treated, or end up in the hospital. And the burden of that cost comes back to all of us one way or the other. If they're an organ health plan patient, it's going to be a higher cost because they're going to be hospitalized, and we're going to have to pay that money out, where they could have been avoiding that by being treated at their local area by the rural physician. That's a huge cost differential. The biggest driver for healthcare costs right now for increasing costs is hospitalization. And we want to avoid hospitalizations at all times for patients unless it's absolutely necessary, just on a cost basis alone. If they go in there as an uninsured patient who could have been taken care of in the rural area, that cost is going to be shifted out to all of us also the same way. Not directly through an organ health plan, but indirectly through higher commercial rates. I think that when we look at this bill, I would like to see a really tight discussion of what our rural physician is. I have some concerns that with the number here of 1,000 MDs and DOs, I'm wondering if some of those are not what we would consider rural anymore, although they may well be so. We need to look at that. But even setting that aside, I think when we look at the cost of this program, we need to also look at what is the gain if we lose those rural physicians. Because if we don't put that into the situation, we could be looking at healthcare costs 3, 4, 5 times as much in the health plan, the organ health plan, just because we've lost our rural physicians. And that's regardless of what happens to the people in their community when they lose their pharmacists, they lose their physician, and they lose these healthcare issues or these healthcare deliveries in their own local area. So I would strongly recommend, even though we have a budget crisis, even though we have these problems, that we consider this as a continuing program and enhancing the program on a cost basis. But we need to do a more careful look at what we're gaining and losing here.
Question.
Any questions?
We have an amendment before us that would add psychologists. Any comments in regards to that addition from either our senators?
This bill asks that we maintain, we open the program up to pharmacists and to psychologists. Living in a rural area does not guarantee good mental health, and you're not going to have any psychiatrists in rural areas. And I would apply the same logic to including psychologists in this that I apply to MDs and DOs. These people will help keep healthcare costs down. The other issue we're talking about is pharmacists. In many rural areas, your pharmacist is a vital part of your team. He doesn't just count out pills and hand them out. The physician in that area, the physician's assistant, the nurse practitioner, really counts on that pharmacist being there. And we are losing these pharmacists in rural areas. And the reason we're losing them is many of the patients in those areas are now sending their prescriptions out of the area to clearinghouses in other states. The prescriptions come through the mail, and the pharmacist is cut out of that business, and that's going to put these people out of business. We have a pharmacy out in a rural area in southern Oregon, Cave Junction, who is fighting for his life to stay open. The patients there want him to stay open, but many of them are sending the prescriptions outside the area. He loses that flow of business, and therefore he's going to lose his business. We don't want that to happen either.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Further questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate you.
Thank you for listening to us this morning.
You bet. Invite Karen Whitaker, Scott, and Tom Holt.
Good morning, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Karen Whitaker. I'm the director of the Center for Rural Health at OHSU, and that has the includes the office of State Office of Rural Health. The Office of Rural Health has administered this tax credit for a long time, so I thought it might help if I went through some of the history and some of the background of this program and just give you some basic facts about it. And I apologize to Senator Metzger and Senator Starr, who have already heard this before in the Health Services Committee, so I'll try to add some new things and not make it so boring. We were the first state to enact a tax credit, and we're still the only state that has a comprehensive tax credit for rural practitioners. We have a lot of experience administering the credit now, and so there are just a few highlights that I'd like to point out for you. And one of them is that the credit has grown, the program has grown from 572 practitioners in 1990 to 1,668 as of tax year 2003. Now, you have only partial figures for tax year 2004 because not everyone has filed their income tax yet for the tax year 2004, although I'm pretty impressed quite a few of them have. While Senate Bill 403 originally applied only to practitioners licensed under ORS 677, which is just physicians, PAs, and podiatrists, we offer the credit to other practitioners, and this pie chart shows you how that breaks down. There are 1,104 MDs, DOs, physicians. There are 304 nurse practitioners, 104 physician assistants, 67 registered nurse anesthetists, 52 dentists, and 18 optometrists, and 19 podiatrists. So we have practitioners all around the state who take advantage of this credit, but it is still the majority of them are physicians. Fact number two I'd like to share with you is that this is the most powerful tool we have. As Senator George pointed out, this sometimes makes a huge difference for physicians who are being recruited to a community and who want to stay in a community. As we also do recruitment services in our office, and we have had many, many practitioners tell us that this is the primary reason that they've chosen a rural practice. And I need to point out that that is not necessarily makes up the difference in income that they would make in an urban area. It doesn't even come close to making up the difference in income. But the symbolic gesture that the state is making to acknowledge the important contribution that these practitioners are making is very meaningful for them. We did a survey in 2001 of physician income. I wish we had something just a little more recent, but that's the last time we did a survey on physician income. And we found out that rural practitioners make considerably less money than their urban counterparts. And the graph in the middle of the second page of my testimony shows you the results of that survey. I think we need to be very cautious, and it's certainly going to be a challenge to get a good revenue impact on this bill, because when we asked them in 2001 how many took the full $5,000 credit, only 87% of the recipients were taking the full $5,000. So if we move the credit up to $10,000, I think it's fair to say that a good portion of them are not going to make enough income to take the full $10,000 credit. So I don't know how in a prospective type of estimate you're going to get a good estimate of what the revenue impact would be, but I think it is important to bear that in mind. On the top of the third page, we compared the results of our Oregon survey to incomes in the U.S. for urban and rural physicians. We did not survey urban physicians in Oregon. That was quite an undertaking for us, and we just didn't have the resources to do that. But you can see by the bar graph that U.S. metro physicians on average were making almost $210,000 a year, and our Oregon rural physicians were making on average about $117,500 a year. both of those numbers may have moved up since 2001, but I don't believe there's any chance at all that the differential could have been breached in that time. So clearly the best incentive we can offer physicians and other practitioners to come to rural Oregon and stay there is economic. Fact number three is that although the program grew very rapidly in the beginning, it has slowed down in growth. And we know that we're having an increasing problem recruiting and retaining physicians in rural Oregon, as Senator Bates pointed out. The graph at the bottom of page three shows you this is an index of the growth in the tax credit program, and it has certainly declined in recent years, and so that is a cause for great concern to us. And the reasons for this are likely multiple. You know, the fact that the credit has not been increased for 15 years. I did look at the consumer price index, and looked, the medical CPI has increased in that time almost 220% from 144.2 to 316.3. So additionally, the recipients of this tax credit must claim the credit as income the following year. And so they don't get the entire credit, of course. The chart in the middle of the final page of text here looks at an overall problem in the state of Oregon. As we try to recruit physicians to rural Oregon, we're also dealing with a statewide shortage of physicians. These two lines on this graph plot the growth in population and the growth in the number of physicians in Oregon since 1954. And you can see there was quite a gap between the lines initially. We were growing our physician population much faster than Oregon population was growing. But then about the middle 80s, this began to decline a bit. And in the year 2000, the two lines crossed, which is a matter of pretty serious concern to us. And what that means is that the growth in population is outpacing the growth in the number of physicians we're able to train and then attract to our state. And so we certainly are experiencing right now and will experience in the future even more a shortage of physicians in Oregon. When we have to compete with urban recruiters to get physicians to go to rural Oregon, we simply can't offer them very much. We do know that in a survey that the Oregon Medical Association and the Medical Professional Review Organization and the Office of Medical Assistance Programs just conducted and released, that rural physicians work longer hours, where they see more patients, they make less money, and they're on call more. So it's very tough to go to a physician and say, we'd like to offer you less money to work harder. And, you know, it's kind of a hard sell. So when we can offer an incentive like a tax credit and to let them know that the state recognizes the work that they're doing, that's very meaningful for them. So in order to turn that around, we need to modify the practice environment. And there are some things about urban-rural differential we can't change. We can't change the isolation. We can't change the distance. Some of the economic issues we can't change, like they get less Medicare reimbursement. That's a federal issue. We can't change that. But we can change this. And so I think it behooves us to do that if we can. I appreciated the senator's comment about the medical offset. I think it's important to understand that every physician in a rural community creates jobs. A study at Oklahoma State University said that for every physician in a rural community, 17 jobs are created. That's a very significant amount of money that people are paying back in for state revenue, and about $400,000 to the community in direct economic benefit. So it's important to remember that as we invest in the rural infrastructure, or rural medical infrastructure, we get money back. And so I would be happy to answer any questions that you have and defer to my colleagues here.
Thank you very much. Senator George and then Senator Metzger.
Thanks. I guess this first one is a comment and then a question. I look at this, and you have two people driving a vehicle. They're both 40 feet long, and one of them is called a truck driver, and the other person is driving a motorhome. And literally, the folks out in the rural community are the truck drivers. They're the ones that are picking up a heavy load, and they're having, as you're talking about, the hours, the responsibility, the personal commitment they make to patients, because they're the only provider of service. But I'm intrigued by one question. I hope you can help me with this. It would appear to me that they're also subject to probably more liability. Is that the case, or is it about the same as in a rural area?
Mr. Vice Chair, Senator George, I don't believe that the rates differ. I think that, certainly as a percentage of their overhead, it is going to be more. Mm-hmm. I can tell you about a situation that isn't too far out of your district. It's over on the coast in Reedsport, where they stopped providing obstetrical services because they lost their general surgeon. And the general surgeon wasn't there to back them up to do cesarean sections if they needed it. All they had were family physicians. They recruited a general surgeon and asked him if he would like to do C-sections, and he said sure. So they got ready to start up the service again. He contacted his liability insurer, who said, okay, now your premium goes from $27,000 a year to $67,000 a year. Well, that was probably more than half of his gross income. And, of course, he couldn't afford for two or three C-sections a year to pay $40,000 more in malpractice insurance. So I think the impact is probably greater, but I think the rates are set on a statewide basis.
Thank you. Senator Metzger.
Thank you. I looked at this before, and I appreciate the data, the breakdown. Have you ever done an audit of actually where some of these people actually work, and besides just by county, as to where their place of employment is, and specifically who they're serving, and who have working with the Department of Revenue on this?
Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Metzger, we do ask them when they apply how many hours a week they work and where. And many of them have a split practice. They may work part of the time in Enterprise, part of the time in Wallowa. You know, they kind of go around to different communities. We don't ask them on an ongoing basis every year when we renew, but we do make sure that they have an Oregon practice address every year. We check that to make sure. So I know they individually get audited from time to time because the Department of Revenue contacts us to ask us for information, and we've signed a letter of agreement where we can exchange information. But we don't know every single one of them every year, no.
Yeah, one of the things to follow up, Mr. Chair, is that going back to what Senator Bates pointed out, if you have a program that you have deemed as in the public's health and benefit, and you have scarce dollars, you've got to make sure that those scarce dollars are actually going to the benefit that you're trying to achieve. And I'll just say anecdotally, because don't have the information, but just on the face of it. For example, and I'll do my district. Virtually every doctor in Hood River. It's probably counted under this. There's 47 MDs in Hood River, which, by the way, is only 43 minutes from Portland, much closer than where I live in Welch's, and I'm not considered that. And Hood River is a wonderful area, certainly, and while we have beautiful rural pear orchards there, the city of Hood River is certainly anything but rural. I mean, Providence, Hood River Hospital, and doesn't take much to attract people there, whereas in some of the other scenarios you're talking about, I think it is very, very difficult. People will work there, or they'll come into Prov Portland, and they'll work back and forth. And, I see the same thing. For example, you have 97 physicians in Josephine County. Are they border Josephine County people who are actually working a lot in Ashland, or in Medford? I just think that because it's very difficult for this body, not only in this issue, but so many other issues that we have heard that we think are, gee, these are on the face pretty good stuff to do, but we have only so many dollars. We want to make sure that those dollars really are going to those areas in which, it would be difficult to have, the proper health care in these types of areas. And that's why, I'm really listening to what Dr. Bates said, is some of these definitions can qualify for a lot of people but aren't really probably in need of attracting people, and other ones then we may not be able to service with some of the requests that have been presented to this committee by expanding this bill, because we haven't exactly targeted as well. And that's why I think it would be really, really good to look at those criteria to make sure that you know, some of these other places, which are on their face very attractive to all many professions, those dollars aren't just going there and not to some of these areas in which, but for, they wouldn't be able to survive.
Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Metzger, I think you make a very valid point. This is a real challenge to apply objective criteria to issues that we know are not objective. And so making these kinds of judgments and then making sure that they are defensible and that we can enforce them on a very plain and equal basis is also kind of a challenge. Our current definition of rural is 10 or more miles from a town of 30,000 or more. So Ashland qualifies as rural, but Medford does not. And that raises an interesting issue, because Ashland right now has an abundance of practitioners and Medford has a shortage of practitioners. And so we're not able to offer the credit to the doctors in Medford, but we can offer it to those that practice in Ashland. So it's kind of an interesting dilemma. And there's a sense of fragility to the rural healthcare system generally, so that one area might be doing very well for a while and then all of a sudden it's not doing very well if they lose some of their physicians. But as areas gain in population, then they're no longer eligible. When we began doing this, Bend was eligible because it was less than 30,000, unbelievably. But when it grew past 30,000, then it was no longer eligible, so practitioners there could no longer receive the credit. There are other areas that are getting pretty perilously close to that right now, and when that happens, we'll have to notify the practitioners there that they can no longer receive the credit. So I think you do raise an interesting point, but it's tough to keep track of that, you know, from year to year if the situations change.
Thank you. Yes, continue.
Vice Chair Starr and members of the committee for the record, I'm Tom Holt with the Oregon State Pharmacy Association. I want to speak this morning particularly about the provision of the bill that would add pharmacists to the program. And I also associate myself with all the comments Karen has made about rural health and Dr. Bates and Senator Bates said, and Senator Westland. You know, the question comes, you know, why do we need to add pharmacists to this program? Well, when it was first created, prescription drugs were not nearly as central to medical care as they are today. We've gone through a generation of really miracle products that now are almost a primary form of care for many conditions. So without the services of a pharmacist in a rural area, you really don't have medical care. There are a number of communities in Oregon that are served by small pharmacies, independently owned, that are not now and will not be in the foreseeable future large enough to be attractive to a Rite Aid or some other, you know, large national chain. Just doesn't fit their business model. Our demographics are a little scary when we look at these areas. Our average age of a pharmacist in these rural areas is at least 5 years older than what we see in the core urban areas of the valley. The incomes are also substantially less from what we can gather than they are in the valley. Issues of coverage are very significant. Even to get away for a day of continuing education is a real challenge for people in these areas because they just don't have enough personnel out there. And you know, we're starting to see people approaching retirement or get to retirement or past normal retirement age, and they just can't hang on any longer waiting to recruit somebody. I'll tell you just two quick stories. We had a pharmacy in Merrill down near the California border close in January. The owners there were around 80 years old. They've been there since the early 1950s. They tried valiantly to recruit some successors. There was nothing wrong with the business, but they really had great difficulty in recruiting anyone. That pharmacy wound up closing, sold their records to a chain, which moved all those records to Medford. That's a long drive in bad weather from Merrill. That means that the rural health clinic in that area no longer has a pharmacy nearby. Now, we've been able to assist them in finding a service that provides a remote technology to have a small number of products on hand that can be done what we call remote dispensing, but that's no substitute for pharmacy services. So there's a potential domino effect when a pharmacy closes to the rest of the health system in an area. In Elgin, up in northeastern Oregon, very similar situation. A pharmacy recently closed there, sold the records to a national chain that their nearest location is about 30 miles away. Now, we already have problems of compliance with prescription drug therapy. When you start making people, about half of prescriptions don't get fulfilled generally. And it's between 50 and 55% as a national statistic. People don't fulfill their prescription orders either in terms of the time they take the medication or even getting it filled in the first place because of cost. You start making people drive long distances just to get their prescription, we know that compliance number is going to get is much worse. And if they don't comply with their drug therapy, then the downstream health care cost is certainly higher. Their condition is going to deteriorate. They're going to end up with a more serious condition. So those are just some of the reasons why we looked at adding pharmacists to the program. Now, what we did in an amendment that the Health Committee added to the bill, we very, very carefully defined who would be eligible because we realized that there are some rural communities where there is a big enough community where a chain is there and they have plenty of resources to attract people for recruiting. So what we did was we looked at our database and tried to drill down to, how could we really focus on the smaller pharmacies that are providing services in the very rural areas. A lot of these are high Medicaid areas, by the way. And what we came up with was they would need to be practicing at a pharmacy that's not part of a group of pharmacies, more than five pharmacies under common ownership. So that there are a number of places where two or three pharmacies, for reasons of helping cover each other on vacations and things like that, they'll have some kind of a light partnership arrangement, but there aren't too many that get up to five. Mostly they're individual pharmacies, standalone. By our calculation and our database, all the information we could gather, statewide, there will be fewer than 140 pharmacists eligible under the criteria we've described. We would expect to work with the Office of Rural Health to further define those criteria so that, for example, Ashland is technically a rural area. We may not need to have that as part of the criteria. But for towns on the coast or out in eastern Oregon, we'd want to define that such that they could be able to participate. So with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Any questions?
Mr. Chairman, Scott Gallant with the Oregon Medical Association. I'll be brief. I'll make a couple of observations, I think, based off of Ms. Whitaker's testimony. We are in a period where the Medical Association is very concerned about the physician workforce. The average age of physicians today, as opposed to a decade ago, is between 50 and 60, and these are physicians who are not thinking about retirement. They are making plans to, in fact, retire. And because of the current work environment, a combination of substantially increasing overhead costs, liability costs, Medicaid reimbursement that's only gone up 9%, while overhead costs have gone up over 30% in the last few years. Medicaid reimbursement, which may well be cut by Congress this year, we're having great difficulty in retaining and recruiting physicians in Oregon. We don't produce enough physicians in Oregon to resupply the workforce that we'll need not too far from now, in our opinion. Medical students, physicians who go into practice average well over $100,000 in debt before they begin practice. And that sort of burden is very difficult to sustain in a rural practice. And we also compete in a national, if not an international, market for physicians today. And the ability to have tools that are necessary or important in order to retain or recruit physicians, I think, is critical for the state, both currently and in the future. This bill was originally crafted to address physicians only, and we are very cognizant of the limitations the state has in regard to revenues in today's market and in budgetary times. I hope that the legislation does not get too broad that it causes a financial impact that might kill the bill. And I have mentioned that to other practitioners, not out of disrespect. I think Mr. Holt makes a great case. I know the psychologists will make another great case. Most mental health services in rural areas are provided by general practice physicians. That's been the case for the last 15 or 20 years. It'll probably be the same case for the next 20 or 30 years. This is really a very important bill for a growing issue that you as policymakers will face down the road. Because those that you represent will be asking why they don't have access to medical services and to physicians to provide those services and what the state might be doing or has been doing in order to stabilize the current environment. And so it may be a daunting task or a bill that may have a substantial fiscal impact at the moment, but it's going to be much greater down the road as more physicians retire in the state. Thank you. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Questions?
I guess one question I would pose is as we raise this credit limit, certainly be an increasing number of those who are covered who will not be able to utilize full credit. Is that not correct?
Mr. Vice Chair, I believe that is correct. I think over time, however, hopefully, that they would be able to utilize it down the road. But I don't think most will utilize the full credit. I think that's probably a correct assumption.
Mr. Vice Chair, may I add something? I was sitting here thinking about what I said to Senator Metzger about Ashland and Medford and realized that I misspoke, and so I'd like to correct the record. The physicians in Ashland are not eligible for the tax credit because the hospital there the rules are rather long and involved and complex, but because the hospital is a type B hospital that is in a metropolitan area, because all of Jackson County is a metropolitan area, those physicians are not eligible. So I wanted to correct the record for that and make sure that you understood that. I apologize.
Vice Chair, if I may, as near as we could determine from what we know about incomes in the very rural areas, we wouldn't anticipate that the people who would be eligible under the criteria we've laid out would come anywhere close to being able to take full advantage of the credit.
Any further questions?
Since it presents, probably for staff, and the way the credit actually works, how much money has to, or revenue has to be realized before they can max out the credit?
No, Chairman Starr and Senator Posansky, there is no criteria as far as the amount they have to earn in a year. Is that what you mean? And they've got to have tax liability, so that's what they have to have. But let's clarify, too, you know, as, you know, Karen Whitaker testified, 87% of the credit is currently being used, fully used. So there's only, you know, when I looked at the numbers, it was really only about 16% that wasn't being used under a 5,000 limit. So currently it's being used. There's not a carry forward on it, so it is being used. And, you know, going up to 10,000 is something we can look at these, you know, average rates and stuff, but it will be used if you go up to a higher rate. So it's not like it's not going to be used.
Is it dollar for dollar? I'm just...
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I would like to follow up on that. You say it will be used, but if they don't have the income or the tax liability, then it will not be used. And many of these folks, according to the information we have, will not have income sufficient to allow the full use of the credit.
Well, Senator Starr, you really need to go through and look at the different returns. I mean, we can't just from looking at this information really gather whether or not they have liability or not. So, I mean, I think it's really a matter of, and I don't know that Department of Revenue can go through the returns and really identify the physician rule credit. So we'll see if we can do some merging of the two data sets, which has been done in the past, but that takes time. So, you know, it's a matter of going through and trying to identify these different people on the and looking at their personal income tax returns and seeing how much liability they still have left. I mean, that's really the only way you can get at this question. That's all I'm trying to clarify is, you know, currently it's being used, and it's being used well. A lot of our tax credits, you've heard about, you know, the R&D credit. Various corporations can't use all their credit. But this is a credit that's clearly being used. So.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. Paul Crossgrove and Damiana Merriweather, please.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Paul Cosgrove representing the Oregon Dental Hygienists Association, and we support Senate Bill 403A. We also have Senator Cruz is one of the prime sponsors of this bill, and he has authorized drafting an amendment to add one more category of practitioner, and I'd like to discuss that with you and tell you how that is a very targeted addition. Some dental hygienists in Oregon have the extra experience to be called whether limited access permit dental hygienists. They're only authorized to practice in certain limited settings, schools, nursing homes, assisted living facilities, community health centers, and rural health clinics. There are 62 of those practitioners in Oregon currently. You have to have 5 years' experience. You have to have additional continuing education and have to have a special permit. But those people are independently practicing without supervision of a dentist in Oregon. Most of those are still practicing in metropolitan areas in the valley, but a few are in rural areas, and we would like to encourage them to move and practice in rural areas. They are the providers of the preventive oral health services that, in fact, if done early with kids and continuously with all of us as we age, can prevent the more expensive restorative work that is otherwise necessary. The reason I think that this issue doesn't raise the kind of targeting questions that maybe have been raised by other committee members is in Ms. Whitaker's testimony, back the eighth page back on one of these pages, talks about the rules for dental practitioners and who is eligible as a dental practitioner for this credit. You have to either practice in a frontier county in Oregon, and frontier county is those very rural counties, Baker, Lake, Wallowa, Gilliam, Malheur, Wheeler, Grant, Morrow, Harney, or Sherman, or you have to practice in a town of less than 5,000 that is more than 25 miles away from any place else that has general dental care. So even a small town next to a community that has a general dentist doesn't qualify. You have to be considerable distance. we would assume if the bill were expanded to cover these limited access permit dental hygienists that the rules for their eligibility would be similar to the rules for dentists, which are the ones I just read for you. So we think it would have a negligible fiscal impact, but if we can encourage just a couple of these folks to do preventive health, oral health services in rural areas, we'd be making a major difference. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Brzezinski.
Thank you. Paul, you said there's 62 that are in the state. Do you know how many would actually, if they were under the dental criteria, how many would actually qualify for looking at the credit?
Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Brzezinski, I have not been able to correlate the 62 licensees with their locations, and I will try to do that and get that information back to you. I don't think there are very many currently in rural areas. We're hoping some of them can find it economically feasible to go to rural areas, and this would be part of the incentive for them to do so.
And if I can follow up, then
yes.
If you could also maybe find out of those that would be within that meet that criteria, kind of what their range of income is.
Mr. Vice Chair Sam Brzezinski, I'd be happy to attempt to do that. I don't have access to their tax returns. Last night I was actually trying to figure my own taxes, and I remember some of these figures from the painful, searing vision of those forms last night. If you are a state income taxpayer, and after you apply your retirement deductions, if you have any, and if you're self-employed, the half of your Social Security, and all your deductions and your exemptions, you don't pay $10,000 of state income tax unless that adjusted gross income is over $105,000. I can assure you that none of the dental hygienists in this state, whether limited access permit or not, urban or rural, or anywhere close to $105,000 of adjusted gross income, but more likely half that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Starr, members of the committee, my name is Damiana Merriweather, and I am here today on behalf of the Oregon Psychological Association. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 403 in the A Ingress version. And as you've heard some earlier discussion about, and some of you were there, Senator Starr and Senator Metzger, when we added psychologists to this bill in the previous committee, and I don't want to take a lot of your time except to talk very briefly about why we feel that this is an appropriate expansion that doesn't necessarily add a tremendous weight to the overall program, but meets a tremendously unmet need in terms of access to quality mental health care in rural communities. Of the professionals identified in the current statute under this, there are no specifically identified mental health providers. Now, there are physicians, psychiatrists do are a specialty of physicians. However, as many of you and I have had conversations in the past, there's an extreme shortage of psychiatrists throughout the state in both urban and rural settings. And as Scott Gallant noted, about 70% of the mental health care that's provided in Oregon right now is provided by family and general practitioners. So they are doing the best they can, but they're definitely struggling to meet a need that's a very specialized need in addition to the care that they provide in general medical care. And that is why we are seeking to add psychologists who are PhD level qualified mental health practitioners to this with credit. I brought with me just a couple of very short stories from folks that I work with who are psychologists and their experience in trying to recruit folks to come out and work with them. Dr. Douglas Marlowe, who practices in Pendleton, and he sees patients from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. 6 days a week. He does take an hour for lunch because he goes for a run, he said. And he has a three-month waiting list for new patients to get in to see him. And he's been attempting to recruit another psychologist to join his practice for nearly a year. He's had a few who've had the qualifications necessary, who he's had conversations with. All but the last one chose to finally have practices in urban areas. And the way he finally enticed the woman who has joined him is by offering her 20% over the going rate in the urban area for her compensation, which is well over what the going rate would be out in his community. But it was just the only way that he could get her to weigh those other those other things that would entice many of us to live in more urban areas. Dr. David Wade, who works at Providence Mount Hood, or excuse me, Providence Hood River Memorial Hospital, has been there for the last 8 years, and they have an outpatient mental health program and an alcohol and drug program, and their setting has resulted in real difficulties recruiting and keeping therapists. They've been advertising for a therapist to run their alcohol and drug program since last September, and now they are considering closing the program because they simply can't find anyone who's willing to come and do that for them. And the area of alcohol and drug treatment is a tremendous need in that community, and closing that program wouldn't be because there aren't folks who need the care. And they've also, likewise in mental health, they've had very few applicants when they've advertised jobs. And then finally, Dr. Robin Henderson, who runs the mental health clinic at St. Charles Medical Clinic. Now, as Karen mentioned, Bend has grown to such an extent that those practicing in Bend would not qualify, but I think it's emblematic of issues all around Central Oregon that she has struggled over the last year, as all three of the psychiatrists who were supposed to provide support for her clinical program have decided not to meet their obligations, and she has gone out of state looking for folks who are willing to come. In addition, we are actually producing psychologists here in Oregon at both George Fox University and Pacific University, which both Senator Starr and Senator George are familiar with those programs. They're coming out of school with a tremendous amount of debt. You know, Scott Gallant spoke about the debt that medical students come out with. And these folks are coming out with a lot of debt, and as they're making their decisions about where to locate, as we've done non-scientific inquiries to those students, would it make a difference to you and how where you settled if you knew that you were eligible for a tax credit that would help? And our response has been very positive and interested in, yeah, that would make a difference to me in choosing where I settled, especially coming out of school with a lot of debt and trying to figure out how I'm going to stay on my feet those first few years. So for all of those reasons, we are here in support of 403, the AM engrossed. The one final piece that I would like to just note is the management that is allowed by Office of Rural Health within this program as it exists and within the bill as we've added psychologists. It allows Office of Rural Health to establish criteria for certifying individuals. And just as they have done in the rulemaking process with Dennis, they have latitude to place rules and restrictions around who would qualify and how they would qualify. And we're very open to working with them in the rulemaking process to focus this in the areas of true need, because there are those anomalies of places that have been discussed where, although they may qualify as rural, may not have the same level of need. And we'd be very open to working to really narrowly target to focus on the areas of need. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Well, thank you very much. Anyone else desiring to testify?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Metzger?
I'd like to ask a question to the Department of Revenue.
Yes.
See, they're here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue.
Thank you. Ms. Buchanan, tell me when these credits are applied, and it talks about they're eligible, as I read through the existing language, and talks about they're eligible to apply for these credits if they have their practice here and you know they meet these other criteria. When if they meet those criteria, they file out a tax return to claim that credit. Is it clearly identified in the return that the credit is only applied against that portion of their income that they earn as a practitioner, or is it just looking at their adjusted gross income? Including income they may generate from other sources.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, it's my understanding that the credit is not limited to the tax generated from income earned in the qualifying practice, that in fact the credit is applied against the total tax liability of the taxpayer or the taxpayers if it is a joint return. And in order to, excuse me, in order to have it apply only to the liability generated from the practice, the statute would need to be changed to restrict it in that manner. That's my understanding.
Well, Mr. Chair, that's a very interesting point because, you know, I'm just developing a scenario. Again, we're trying to target these dollars to where they're really going to help, you know, provide the end result. Let's say I'm a physician and I have other interests, and I'm basically maybe a part-time physician and now because I have other interests that I do, other investments, et cetera. And I can do 60% of the work that I do. It's just that I don't do 100% of work, but 60% of it may be in a particular area. Therefore, I qualify, and maybe I've done $30,000 or $40,000 just to throw out a figure of medical practice. But, you know, I've got $50,000 in other income from other, you know, business LLCs that I'm involved in or whatever, and then what you're telling me is that that credit, even though it may not be enough for to offset what I've earned as doing my medical practice, my other income that I have generated could then eat up the rest of that credit, potentially, even though it was unrelated to physician service.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, I believe what you have described is correct, but I really would appreciate having an opportunity to verify my memory.
I think that would be important.
I will do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Relative to that concept, I know it's a question you can't ask, and maybe it's a case we get Karen back up here, but my assumption would be that if you have a practitioner who's going to move to a rural area and is going to expect a substantially reduced amount of income, that in fact it would be only logical that they would look for some other way to make money, and if we're going to keep them there, wouldn't in fact we need to provide an incentive based upon the fact that we might actually protect some of their other income, it would subsidize them being in that rural area where if they're not there, the health care is zero. And so, Karen, can I get you back up here? I mean, at least an opinion on that concept, because, if you're trying to pay back that debt and you have your fixed cost, and as we talked about, you know, your liability insurance as a percentage of your total practice is going to be higher, just because you can't divide them so much money. And then you add on to this that you're going to probably need some other type of investments or something that might yield an additional income. Do you think that's correct, or am I just kind of carrying it too far?
Mr. Vice Chair, Senator George, I wish I could answer your question. I don't think we have any data to show what sort of outside income any of our rural physicians might be making. We know that they work pretty long hours, so they probably don't have a lot of time to pursue other forms of income. But I think the question that Senator Metzger raised is a very valid one. And I'm not a tax expert. I don't work with the Department of Revenue. But my understanding from the years of experience with this is that the credit is taken against adjusted gross income, period. Whatever amount a physician practices in a rural area, if they, however many hours their entire practice consists of, then if 60% or more of their practice is in a rural area, then they qualify for the credit. But Senator George is absolutely right. I think what we do then is entice some physicians to practice even part-time who wouldn't otherwise be practicing. There are a lot of physicians who are trying to retire, who would like to retire, but who come back and practice part-time, and that is quite a great incentive for them to do so. So I think it balances out, but you have asked a very interesting question, and I don't think we can estimate what the impact of that is. We don't have that much information.
Senator Brzezinski.
I guess to take counterpoint to that is you also have individuals that are going to be receiving other type of benefits, such as not paying their professional, their insurance can be waived, because I know that's one of the bills we have now is looking at reducing the liability for doctors who have retired who want to actually start back their practice in certain settings and pay for like low income and stuff like that. So I think there's a lot of counterbalances here, and one of my concerns is that we see the need to expand these credits out to other groups. I'm concerned that we're going to make the pie so big that we may not be able to maintain it to the point of where we need to. So I think there's a lot of possibilities here, but it's still a work in progress.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask
yes.
a question? Karen, I'm looking at your graph right here with mm-hmm. a very disturbing set of lines, which I've been on health committees that these committees drive me crazy. I have to tell you the truth. I'm going to need that psychologist. But because you see all these lines going in the wrong direction. And my question is this. I mean, as the competition gets more, is going to increase, the demand for a physician or the druggist in any given area, that means the price is going to go up. That means it's going to be less affordable in a rural area. And I'm really concerned about that. If you look at the total of our Health and Human Services budget, you know, you're talking about close to $10 billion, and we're talking about $12 million for a biennium to maintain, you know, a staff of people in any given area of the state. I mean, that's, I think, part of the balancing, too, is to look how little of a piece this really is relative to our total cost in health care.
Mr. Vice Chair, Senator George, I think indeed we're talking about a modest amount of money in speaking in relative terms. And as the lobbyist for the Psychological Association said, there are times when you actually have to pay a premium to recruit someone. Senator Bates was talking about Chuck Hoffman over in Baker City, who had such a hard time recruiting physicians. I know at one point he and his partners, when he had partners, took a cut in pay so that they could pay the person they were recruiting more. So they were making, you know, overall, it was no more money being spent on the practice because there was no more money, but he took a cut, he and his partners, and they were actually paying their new physician more than they were making. And in fact, they weren't able to retain that physician. He eventually left. And, because there are so many other factors besides income in practicing in a rural community, the isolation and the local schools and whether or not the spouse can find work and so on. And so there are a lot of other, it's a complex issue. But no, you're absolutely right. It's a modest investment overall, I believe, for a good return.
Thank you. Appreciate very much your testimony, your
Thank
help
you.
Here this morning. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 403 and open up public hearing on Senate Bill 758. We have people signed up for 758. Have no one signed up for...
Yeah, Chairman Starr, this is a bill we have heard before. So this is the same as a Senate bill, I think it was 19, we heard last week, I think it was, just dealing with that exempting the military compensation for the active duty National Guard, military reservists, or organized militia from personal income tax. So it's just for that active duty that is performed here in Oregon, and that was kind of the discussion that we had last time. So it's just for, and allows in refunds to go forward until July 1st of 2006. So we don't have any really new information on it or anything.
I thank you. Questions? We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 758, and we're adjourned until 8:30 on Wednesday.